The following message is brought to you by Terry Moore. And now, Mr. Moore.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bradick, and happy Sabbath to everyone. Let's go ahead and open up to Exodus 20 to begin. Exodus 20. 7 months ago, I had began a series of sermons about the commandments. And the last time, speaking of the commandments, I had covered the fifth commandment, honoring our parents. And so today I would like to go ahead with this series and move to number six. And number six, the sixth commandment, very plainly and clearly reads, "You shall not murder." And this is found in Exodus 20 and verse 13. It's also found in Deuteronomy 5 and verse 17. Now, the King James version of this sixth commandment translates it as, "Thou shalt not kill," as opposed to "you shall not murder." But both of these translations are correct. They do correctly translate the Hebrew text. But I think the New King James might give a slightly better rendering, revealing that God's definition of a wrong form of killing is actually classified as murder. And so murder is the concern here. And murder, we're all probably aware, connotes intentional killing of a person who is innocent, a person that is undeserving of death or such malice. Now, because murder relates to fatally wounding another human being, we see that it bears its mark on the sixth commandment. And interestingly, this is a part of the information that helps us to understand that six sometimes refers to the number of human beings, humanity. And so Adam and Eve, the first of mankind, we understand were created on the sixth day. And also, people were given 6 days every week to do their own human work. But the seventh day is dedicated to God, solely to God. And so the sixth commandment, then, therefore, is not to murder other men or women. And so murder is a sinister act. It's born out of a hatred, or it's born out of selfish desires. And there are those who have also killed others because not just because of extreme dislike, but many have actually killed in a desire to take what another person might possess. And there are even some that have killed innocent individuals in order to hide their own evidence or an evidence of wrongdoing on their part. And of course, we understand that that would be an extremely selfish act. Exodus 21, regardless of the circumstance, murder is one of the worst sins a person can commit. And although all sin requires the death or required the death of Christ in order to atone for our sin, there are degrees of sin. Some are worse than others. Exodus 21 and verse 12 states that he who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. And this is speaking of murder. And the sentence for which is the penalty is the same penalty God declared for intentional Sabbath breaking or dishonoring parents or adultery or bestiality or worshiping false gods. These are all atrocious acts. And God declared to Israel that those who committed them intentionally were to be put to death. Numbers 33. It's understood by most, but must be mentioned anyway, that murder is the crime, and it involves killing someone who does not deserve to die. It's not talking about death that's inflicted in self-defense. It's not talking about capital punishment. And the sixth commandment also does not relate to those who might be killed in a just war. And the reason this needs to be made clear is that it has been necessary to kill on occasion. There are times when killing is the way for justice to be served or the way of cleansing evil from a land. And we understand in Ecclesiastes 3:3, Solomon wrote that there is a time to kill. There is a time to heal also, and a time to break down, and a time to build up. And this was especially true when it came to Israel entering the promised land. Canaan was a region of land that was promised to Abraham, to promise to his descendants, that is. And when it finally came to receiving their inheritance, Israel was instructed to cleanse the land of the various heathen tribes that inhabited it. Numbers 33, and beginning in verse 50, some of these instructions where it says, "The Eternal spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan across from Jericho, saying, 'Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you have crossed the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land from before you. Destroy all their engraved stones, destroy all their molded images, and demolish all their high places. You shall dispossess the inhabitants of the land and dwell in it, for I have given you the land to possess. You shall divide the land by lot as an inheritance among your families. To the larger you shall give a larger inheritance, to the smaller you shall give a smaller inheritance. And therefore everyone's inheritance shall be whatever falls to him by lot. And you shall inherit according to the tribes of your fathers.'" And then God says, "But if you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land from before you, then it shall be that those whom you let remain shall be irritants in your eyes and thorns in your sides, and they shall harass you in the land wherever you dwell. And moreover, it shall be that I will do to you as I thought to do to them." And so God said to drive everyone out of the land. And if they simply left the land, that would be fine and well. However, most did not want to leave the land. Most passionately remained in the promised land to Israel. They resisted, and God therefore said to destroy them, to destroy every man, woman, and child of those pagan people, and along with destroying all their places of worship and all of their idolatrous paraphernalia, if you will. And so many in our politically correct societies would look at such directions, instructions from God, and say that that's cruel, barbaric, unfair, even racist, they would call it. However, what they don't realize is that those people who Israel was told to kill, to drive out of the land, these were not innocent individuals. They were not innocent. They were guilty of rank idolatry. They were guilty of burning their own children in offerings to other gods, false gods. And so this was a crime we understand God said is punishable by death. Death. In addition, God said that if any of these people were left in the land, they would be a thorn in the side of the nation, and they would persecute God's people. But not only so, they would influence Israel to worship other gods, false gods. And this eventually did happen to the nation of Israel. And it was in large measure because Israel did not remove everyone from the borders of Canaan as instructed. They left people within the land. Now the point is, that needs to be understood in this, is that killing is not always murder. And though I wouldn't encourage anyone to try to decide for themselves when it comes to our personal situations, the fact that remains that God gave a sixth commandment to not murder. And then he commanded Israel to kill. And so this was not a violation of his own law. It was not an oxymoron. No, there is intentional killing that is just. And then there is killing that is murder. And the type of killing that violates the sixth commandment is murder. And so now that we understand that, if we didn't already, hopefully it's clear now. Let's go to Deuteronomy 19. There is another form of killing that does not violate the sixth commandment. And this was read about and discussed in detail during the Feast of Tabernacles while we covered the law in those readings. And that command, or that which does not violate the sixth commandment, is unintentional or accidental death that's caused by someone other than the deceased. And this is known today as manslaughter, and it's referred to in the scriptures as a person, an individual who causes someone to die unintentionally is referred to as a manslayer. This is pointed out in Deuteronomy 19. Deuteronomy 19, beginning in verse 1, God gave these instructions for cities of refuge. "When the Eternal your God has cut off the nations whose land the Eternal your God is giving you, and you dispossess them and dwell in their cities and in their houses, You shall separate three cities for yourself in the midst of your land, which the Eternal your God is giving you to possess. And you shall prepare roads for yourself and divide into three parts the territory of your land, which the Eternal your God is giving you to inherit, that any manslayer may flee there. And so not only were they to make cities of refuge, they were to make it these cities easily accessible, so that those people who found a need to flee to them were not, you know, caught in the way by pursuers, those who might want some kind of revenge. They were to be able to get to these cities safely and clearly. And so it says, this is the case of the manslayer, in verse 4, who flees there, that he may live. Whoever kills his neighbor unintentionally, not having hated him in time past. And he gives an example, as when a man goes to the woods with his neighbor to cut timber, and his hand swings a stroke with the axe to cut down the tree, and the head slips from the handle and strikes his neighbor so that he dies. It's unintentional, accidental. He shall flee to one of these cities and live, lest the avenger of blood, while his anger is hot, pursue the manslayer and overtake him, because the way is long, and kill him. And though he was not deserving of death, there was no real crime committed here, since he had not hated the victim in the past. And then God goes on to say that if their borders are increased, they are to add additional cities of refuge. In verse 9, you shall keep all these commandments and do them, which I command you today, to love the Eternal your God and to walk in his ways. And then you shall add three more cities for yourself besides these three, lest innocent blood be shed in the midst of your land, which the Eternal your God is giving you as an inheritance, and the guilt of bloodshed be upon you. And so the person who accidentally killed someone was not guilty of murder. But if those people did not, if Israel did not provide a city of refuge and did not allow for this person involved to have a place of safety, if you will, to live in, then the nation would be guilty of murder. Bloodshed would be upon them because they allowed someone to kill someone out of hatred. Hatred, and we're getting to the spirit of murder, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. So those people who did commit murder were stoned to death. And those who killed by accident did not violate any of God's law, and therefore God did not require a severe punishment to them. However, relatives or friends of the deceased might be very upset at what took place, very hurt, and they might even become hostile. And for this reason, God said, you know, you have to protect these individuals. They're innocent. Do not let people take out their own form of vengeance that they might feel necessary. And so it's clear that this is not the kind of killing that is forbidden in the sixth commandment. Ecclesiastes 8. I'm going to kind of cover all of the various forms of killing, and then we'll talk about the intent of the law in a moment. But despite the fact that everyone, even unbelievers, in the society we live in today, in different societies around the world, everyone understands that murder is morally wrong. Most countries, most countries minimize murder. And they even glorify murderous acts in movies and on television, in video games. Whether people want to believe it or not, the evidence, I think, is clear that this kind of entertainment found in our modern world, it does have its effect on people. And movies and video games are actually leading some people to carry out wicked and even murderous acts. The United States Bureau of Justice reported that 14,000 murders and 1.5 million violent crimes occur in America every year. In the larger cities, 3 to 5 murders are committed every day, some cities even more. And these statistics, of course, do not include those homicides that cannot be defined as murder, where they don't really know. Today, we hear stories on occasion, and even recently, of children and young adults that will go on killing sprees in schools or on college campuses. There have been a record of deranged adults that will abduct other human beings and fulfill their sick desires on them and then leave them for dead. And perhaps the highest insult in these murderous acts, as well as to God anyway, and as well as to those victims of these violent crimes, is when people allow criminals such as this to live out their lives, to be fed, to have medical care the rest of their lives, and to go through years and years of appeals as the government spends hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars even, on keeping these criminals alive, which actually are deserving of nothing but death. And this frequently occurs in what I would call a very unjust justice system, such as we have in America. And then in many of these cases, we will set them free. Set them free because of good behavior. But their victims, they didn't have that option at all. They didn't have a chance to be set free because of good behavior. And so by this process, we do send a clear message to criminals that they can commit terrible crimes, that they can even commit murder, and yet they will be protected from swift and just punishment. And such injustice generates what? More crime, more murder. And this is an activity that we see take place every day in the courtrooms of America. In Ecclesiastes 8, it says, "Because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil." And this is what we see taking place. If countries such as America would take swift action against lawless, even murderous individuals, many would think twice before doing wrong. But because we allow criminals to receive what might be considered the equivalent of a slap on the wrist or a good talking to, "You've been very bad now, you go over there, sit on the naughty mat for a while." That's kind of what we're saying. And we'll feed you, we'll take care of you, we'll give you health care. You have entertainment, you can work out, play pool, have television even. You've been a bad boy. That's what we tell to a lot of criminals. And because of that, we see that crime just increases. Evildoers then take little thought before harming the innocent, because they see, well, it's not going to be that bad. Even if I get caught, I'll still be able to live out my life. Let's go to Matthew 5. In addition to breaking the letter of the sixth commandment today, we live in a world that is seething with anger and hatred. For example, the radical Islamic community is constantly irate, violent, and murderous. And then we have many minorities in various societies that are consistently raging because of their circumstances, and the accusation of being racist is like a go-to word when anything doesn't go their way. However, like all the commandments, there is a letter of the law and there is a spirit or intent of the law. And so hateful, hostile, resentful emotions, these break the spirit of the sixth commandment. And Christ made this clear in Matthew 5 and verse 21 when he said, "You have heard it said to those of old, 'You shall not murder,' and 'Whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment. But I say to you, that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whoever says to his brother, Raka, which is a word meaning you're worthless, shall be in danger of the council. But whoever says, 'You fool,' which is a Greek expression meaning moros, or basically calling someone a moron or an idiot, whoever says this shall be in danger of hellfire." Now, the reason Christ gave us this warning is because hatred, he points out, is a spiritual type of murder. And if we think about it, we can realize that anger is the first step to insult, which can lead to injury. And hatred, we understand, often results in disrespectful and comments, and it can lead to unlawful actions. It might start as unkind words, resentment, but dislike, untamed, can eventually cause people to try and harm the person that they are opposed to. Their believed enemy is that they might seek to discredit or defame or hurt them because they're hurting, carrying out their own form of justice, if you will. Anger and resentment have frequently led to intense hostility, causing violence that has been passed down through generations. And today we can see this firsthand in the Middle East, the animosity between Abraham's sons, Esau and Isaac. This is still being exhibited today between many of the Arab peoples and the Jews. Even in America, we are no longer the melting pot that we once were. It seems that every nationality feels that they are superior in some way, and so they will try to establish their own values within a free society. However, instead of encouraging solidarity by allowing this to take place, today we find we live in a nation that seems to be more divided than ever. 1 John in chapter 2. But we, as Christians, we are different, aren't we? No, these things don't affect us. We don't get angry. We don't feel resentment. We don't hate others, do we? You know, we say, hate the sinner, love the sin. That didn't come out right, did it? But I know what some of you are thinking. Yeah, preach it. I hate that guy, but I love what he's doing. I had to borrow that from Tim Hawkins, but the point, I think, is well taken. We like to think that we could never break the sixth commandment. And perhaps we wouldn't in the letter by physically murdering someone. But do we break the spiritual intent of this law? Do we really love the sinner while hating the sin? Or do we tend to hate both of them at the same time? Especially when it comes to an offense that actually hurts us. Do we feel anger that intensifies? Do we feel resentment, possibly even hatred toward other people from time to time? Have we ever been hurt, offended by someone? Then we don't have any desire to reconcile. Don't want to do it, don't want to go there, but would rather harbor our resentment, hang on to it. I'd rather feed my bitterness, you know, having a self-righteous attitude that I'm justified in this hatred. I'm going to keep it for a while. I've seen this happen. I've seen it happen personally to a number of God's people, and yet they will continue to feel like they are fully in the faith. But John said this in 1 John 2, and he was actually paraphrasing something Christ said. 1 John 2 and verse 9, where it says, he who says he is in the light and hates his brother is in darkness until now. And he who loves his brother abides in the light, and there is no cause for stumbling in him. But he who hates his brother is in darkness and walks in darkness and does not know where he is going, because the darkness has blinded his eyes. And so do any of us, I think, sometimes claim to be in the light of Christ while hating others? You know, resentment, as John points out here, it leads to spiritual blindness. It actually distorts our judgment and our thinking. And it's because Christ's light will begin to fade in an individual that has such an attitude, and it can cause us to stumble in our Christian walk. Let's go to Luke 14. The times when we do not want to reconcile with someone else are actually the times when we really should reconcile. We've heard the principle of, you know, when we sin, we generally do not want to go right to God because we are feeling guilty. We don't want to go talk to him. But those are the times when we really should go to God. Keep that relationship with him. It's the same when it comes to reconciliation and offense. The times when we don't want it, we don't want to reconcile, those are the times when we really should make things better, because it helps us to stay in the light. Despite this, some church members will attempt to justify animosity. And some try to reason that hatred of other people is acceptable, depending on the circumstance. And of course, in their circumstance, it would be acceptable. Some actually believe that Christ told us that we should hate other human beings. And they'll read scriptures such as Luke 14 in verse 26. Oh, there we go. Well, Christ said, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother and wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, his own life, also he cannot be my disciple. Now, oddly enough, understanding that the commandments are based upon love, love of God and love of other people, I think the scripture is still misunderstood by some. You see, when Christ expresses here that we are to hate others and follow him, he's not saying to actually hate them with a type of anger, an animosity towards them. No, what he is saying is by extension to love them less. To love them less than we love God. It doesn't mean that we're to hate our parents and to hate our brothers and sisters and our family. It means that we are to love God more than we love them. We're loving God more than anything else. As Christ said, this is the first aspect of the law, of the commandments. To love God with all your heart, all your life, and all your mind. And the second is similar to it, to love others as you love yourself. Still, we are to love God more. And that is what Christ is saying here. He's not saying to literally hate people. I hate them. No, that's not what is being said. And we have to understand that. I think most of us do. But what it means is to put God first and foremost in our lives. His law precedes everything we do. Have a love of him and his law above all else. As David wrote, oh, how love I your law. It's ever with me. I'm thinking about your law and everything I do and how I'm applying my work habits and my thought process and my relationships with other people, always considering God and his law. Back to Matthew 5. Despite this, some continue to misunderstand Matthew 5, at least in part. And there are those who feel that animosity can be justified and that the scriptures can justify animosity. And I think this might be because of a misinterpretation of Matthew 5 and verse 22. We had already read this, but I want you to look at it again, where it says, I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. Now, some will read this and they'll think, well, because Christ said that if we are angry without a cause, we are in danger, this must mean that if we have a cause, we can harbor resentment. We can be angry, even allow ourselves to feel hatred to another person. But this is not the case. I actually gave a sermon about 3 years ago on this subject titled Angry Without a Cause. And in short, it must be recognized that the expression without a cause is not found in the original text. Let me give you a few examples. The American Standard Version renders this scripture, I say unto you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be in danger of the judgment. Without a cause is not included. The English Standard Version, I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. The Good News Bible, I tell you that if you are angry with your brother, you will be brought to trial. The Complete Jewish Bible, but I tell you that anyone who nurses anger against his brother will be subject to judgment. The Lexham English Bible, the Revised Version, the Bible in Basic English, the English Version, the DRB, all of these say, but I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother shall be in danger of the judgment. Without a cause is not found in more than half of the translations out there. And so this means that we can't really justify hatred, can we? We can't use the Bible to justify hatred. And Christ's own words reveal this truth. And so we are never justified in clinging to resentment. We are never justified in trying to harm others because we don't like them, because they hurt us. We were offended in some way. And Christ, he addressed this truth shortly after pointing out the intent of the sixth commandment here in Matthew 5. And if we go down to verse 43... He said, "You have heard it said that you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies. Bless those who curse you. Do good to those who hate you. And pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. For he makes his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. For if you only love those who love you, what reward have you? Do not even the tax collectors, those people who don't even believe God in God, don't they do the same? And if you greet your brethren only, what do you do more than others? Do not even the tax collectors do so? Therefore, he said, you shall be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. Be holy as I am holy, as is stated many times in the scriptures. So the sum of the matters here, Christ says, is to be perfect. And this is a Greek word, teleos. It does not mean without flaw, to not have one bit of flaw within your body, although that would be wonderful. I think that's impossible for any human being to achieve while being mortal. But what it means is to be spiritually mature. It means to be complete in mental and moral character. That is the kind of perfection that Christ is telling us to achieve, because that can be achieved. Yes, we can achieve that as human beings. And the type of maturity that we seek in this way leads us to not be affected by the emotions of hatred. But this doesn't mean that we can never hate. We can hate, but not the people. Hate sin, but not the sinner. Got it right this time. See, we're all sinners, and the only emotion that should be felt toward other sinners is a degree of love, a degree of compassion. A love, of course, that is less than the one that we feel toward God. He is first and foremost. But still, it's a similar love in its nature. Exodus 23 Because we are human, we will feel that we have been wronged on occasion. We will get hurt by others. We might be offended, and we may even get angry at times. Anger unrestrained to other people could lead us to try and harm another person. It's human nature to try to return hurt for hurt. But we have to be careful in this. We have to keep ourselves in check, because our attempts to harm someone as Christians is usually not going to result in death, in actual murder. But the spirit of murder that Christ pointed out here, this is not limited to physical force, to causing one's heart to stop beating or their lungs to stop breathing. You see, defamation is another aspect of spiritual murder, and we can lead this to gossip. We can consider openly criticizing other people in a disrespectful way. Attempts to damage somebody's reputation among others, or even among their own friends, through what might be libel or slander. This too is a violation of the sixth commandment. I think this is mentioned at least in part in Exodus 23. Exodus 23, where it says, "You shall not circulate a false report. Do not put your hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness." And of course, this is based upon the ninth commandment, but I think it can be applied to the spiritual or intent of murder. "You shall not follow a crowd to do evil, nor shall you testify in a dispute as to turn aside after many to pervert justice." Yeah, don't unleash our own form of justice. No. "You shall not show partiality to a poor man in his dispute. And if you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey going astray, you shall surely bring it back to him." Yes, this is how we show love, by showing, like, look, I'm not going to, even if you don't like me, I'm not going to treat you unfairly. I'm going to treat you respectfully and out of concern. If you see the donkey of one who hates you lying under its burden, and you would refrain from helping it, you shall surely help him with it. You shall not pervert the judgment of your poor in his dispute. Keep yourself from a false matter. Do not kill the innocent and righteous, for I will not justify the wicked or such wickedness. And so we see God relating false reports to showing partiality and refusing to help others. This is leading up to killing the innocent and the righteous. In Ezekiel 22 and verse 9, you don't need to turn there, but that talks about people who slander to cause bloodshed, trying to bring about their own form of justice. They hate and they'll defame in order to cause others to hate as well. You know what they say, misery loves company. And some who are miserable or feel offended, they might try to spread their unhappiness in an attempt to justify themselves or an attempt to inflict their own revenge. But this kind of vengeance, God said, it's his. Revenge is mine. It's his doing, not ours. It's going to be a little short today, so in closing, I just want to point out that anger and resentment, hatred, if you will, this is the seat of where murder begins. And this was shown, I think, in the cases of the accidental death. When we read about those cities of refuge, what was stated in those scriptures? It said that the manslayer had not hated his victim in the past, and therefore this person is innocent. See, a lack of contention was evidence that the person was not guilty of murder. And therefore, hatred prior to a person's death would be evidence of murder. It would be evidence of the person's guilt. And so we see then that this is where the seed of murder sprouts. It's in the fertile ground of hatred, animosity, resentment, hostility. These are all emotions that we should try to avoid. However, we should recognize that not all forms of hate are bad. We should hate sin. Hate the sin, but don't hate those other people that might sin even against us. We should get angry if necessary to try to take sin out of our own lives to keep it from taking its toll on us. But do not let our anger get out of control to the point where we start directing it at other people. Do not let indignation result in a spiritual form of murder. Keep our emotions in check. Keep a guard on our mouths. Keep our attitudes in check. Be spiritually mature, as Christ said.